Carolyn and I are going to do is start thinking about what possible dimensions of the American healthcare system we should be considering as we go down this road with the presidential candidates and ultimately with whoever that president is.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jerry Beliles, Director of the Miller Center of Public Affairs, and I want to welcome you today to this forum on healthcare with Tim Garson, the Provost of the University, and Carolyn Engelhardt, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the School of Medicine. This is the first installment of what will be an annual healthcare program endowed by two of the Miller Center's best friends, Peyton and Janet Weary. Peyton and Janet are among the most enthusiastic supporters of the Miller Center and its forum program. Theirs was the very first gift to the Ken Thompson Endowment Fund for the forum established a few years ago. And last year, they generously made a significant gift that helped match a grant from the Perry Foundation to be used to upgrade the sound and lighting in this very room. That work will be undertaken this summer. Peyton and Janet Weary are also charter members of our presidential cabinet, the Miller Center's most important annual donor circle. And in 2003, Peyton and Janet helped to organize a seven-part forum series entitled Aging Well, National Policy Issues and Answers. Obviously, healthcare is a subject of importance to Dr. Weary, who served as professor of dermatology and chairman of the Department of Dermatology at the university's medical school, and he is also past president of the American Academy of Dermatology. In 2005, Peyton Weary received the Miller Center Foundation's Elizabeth Scott Award for exemplary leadership in recognition of his outstanding contributions to the Miller Center of Public Affairs, the University of Virginia, and the local community. Janet Weary is a local artist who is also very active in community affairs, having served on the board of directors for several organizations, including the Charlottesville Children's Theater, the University Art Museum Volunteer Board, and the University of Virginia's Health Center Arts Committee. We are very grateful to Peyton and Janet for their leadership, for their community service, for their tangible support for the wonderful gift that has established this new endowment. Peyton and Janet are joined today by many friends and their daughter, Carolyn Brandt. In recognition of their latest benefaction and continuing every year in perpetuity, this annual forum will bear their names, the Peyton and Janet Weary Forum on Healthcare. And I hope that you will join me in recognizing and saluting these two very good friends, Peyton and Janet Weary. Thank you, and I'm now pleased to turn the program over to its moderator, George Gillum.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. As many of you know, on April 9th in Boston, we will be holding another in the series of debates and discussions. The one in Boston will be on this question. Americans have a fundamental right to health care, and it is the obligation of government to secure that right. And as we've done with each of the previous debates, there will be posted on our website lots of preliminary information about the topic, a white paper that presents both sides of the argument. And in this case, the white paper was prepared by Tim Garson and Carolyn Engelhardt, who are speaking with us today. Carolyn Engelhardt is Assistant Professor of Medical Education in the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. She earned her MPA at the University of Virginia. Arthur Garson Jr., who everyone knows as Tim, is Executive Vice President and Provost of the University of Virginia. Tim Garson was educated at Princeton and Duke and did his training in pediatrics at Duke. He completed his training in pediatric cardiology at Baylor. In 1992, he earned a master's in public health, specializing in health policy and healthcare finance. He has served as president of the American College of Cardiology. He joined the University of Virginia as vice president and dean in 2002 and took his present position last year. Engelhardt and Garson have written Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths, Not Enough Reality. One of the most remarkable and useful parts of this important book is the extensive notes. There are about 130 pages of footnotes with lengthy quotes from many of the sources to which they've referred. Very useful as we enter the current political season and the debates over healthcare. Carolyn Engelhardt and Tim Garson today are going to outline for us the contours of this debate, and we will have plenty of time for questions and answers after they finish their opening remarks. Please welcome Carolyn Engelhardt and Tim Garson.
Thank you, George, Governor, friends. It is an honor, as I think about the past Miller Center forums that I've been privileged to come listen to and participate in. It's an honor to be part of one of these fora, and it's an especial honor, Peyton, to have you and Jan here, and thank you so much for your donation, and we'll try and live up to the reputation that you'd like us to have. So thank you again, Peyton. We're not going to deal with the debate because the debaters are going to deal with the debate. That's what next week or April 9th is all about. So what Carolyn and I are going to do briefly is talk with you about some of the few principles in the white paper, not specifically about whether healthcare is a right, but some things perhaps to start the debate thinking, to start all of us thinking about what possible dimensions of the American healthcare system we should be considering as we go down this road with the presidential candidates and ultimately over the next several years with whoever that president is. So I'm going to share with you five dimensions, five principles that may be worthwhile for you to think about as we go forward. And then what Carolyn's going to do is discuss a little bit more about how each of the candidates may or may not fit with those principles. Now, none of this is going to be, I hope, by virtue of the fact that you're here, none of this is going to be new to you. But hopefully it will give you a little bit more of an organized way to think out how to deal with some of these. So, for example, does the presidential candidate, does whatever it is that's being proposed, decide that everyone in the United States should have health care coverage or not? Now, you're going to have to decide among yourselves whether that's important to you, because there are certainly some that would say, you know what, it's fine that everybody doesn't, in that people should work for themselves, people should figure out how to get their own health care coverage. As you'll see in the debate, there are those that think that the government should provide health care coverage, there are those that don't. But I think you need to decide among yourselves, is it important that everybody has health care coverage? It's worth talking about the difference between coverage and access. I happen to be fortunate enough to be dealing with two different organizations in Washington and helping put principles together for two different organizations' healthcare plans, one of which says healthcare access is important, one of which says healthcare coverage is important. Let me tell you the difference. Healthcare access means that you have the way to get to an appropriate practitioner at the right time, in the right setting. So, for example, that would mean that people in Southwest Virginia, that would mean that people in rural Wyoming, That would mean that people in downtown New York City can get access to a practitioner of the appropriate type, whether it's a nurse, a generalist, or a specialist, at the right time. That's access. Coverage, simply, not so simply, means that you have the ability to have somebody else pay for your health care. That's coverage. So somebody else is paying for your health care. You clearly will, to some extent, pay for some of it. In some situations, none of it. But in many situations, some of it. But what health care coverage means, even if you are your own self-insured, it means someone else is taking part of that risk. Those are very different. Those are very different. There are people in Southwest Virginia who may be covered by Medicare and Medicaid who have no access by virtue of the fact they can't get to see anybody. Similarly, there are clearly people who have some degree of access in Charlottesville who can come to the emergency room but have no coverage. Those are very different things. You've heard in the past certain people beyond Charlottesville talk about that access to the emergency room is enough. It is not. It is not enough to have access to emergency rooms. You do not have the ability to get preventive care. You don't have the ability to get follow-ups for illness. You don't have the ability to get medicine. So emergency rooms don't do it. Emergency rooms, I'm certainly glad to be part of a system that has access to an emergency room. It's not enough. So one, coverage. Two, if there is to be a system, what is the organization of that system in terms of, is it completely public? Is it completely private? Or is it a mix? So you will hear the term single payer, which by and large only means how is the medical care and health care paid for. That does not necessarily mean socialized medicine. Socialized medicine means the doctors and the hospitals all work for the government. Well, it looks like no one here is over 65, so very few of you are covered by Medicare. But Medicare is a single payer. Does it feel like socialized medicine? No. No. Okay, so there are different ways in which healthcare can be organized, some public, some private. There are different candidates' approaches to whether it is entirely private, meaning that everyone would have access to an insurance plan and no public safety net. There are those that would say, why not have a complete safety net and have that safety net paid for by the public and then have people buy private insurance above that? And there's everything in between. As you're thinking about health plans, think about there are only really two options for growth of coverage of the uninsured, either more public, as in greater Medicaid or state children's health insurance program funding, greater Medicare coverage, that's public, or greater private coverage where people have to buy coverage and therefore, as in Massachusetts, are subsidized. Now, a word about what health insurance costs. Because when people talk about a private system that then results in a subsidy, what is generally thought of as reasonable is about 5% of income. So generally, whether it's here or England or France or Australia or Japan or Holland, somewhere around 5% of income, if you make $20,000 a year, it is generally thought that around $1,000 a year is perhaps affordable, but not more than that. Even at the lower incomes, it may be even less, 2 to 3 to 4%. Now think about for a minute that in the individual market out in the world, not in the employer market, but in the individual market, the best that one can do is about $3,000 for an individual premium. Now, $3,000 is 5% of $60,000. So it is really not until one gets to an individual income of about $60,000, that one can buy an individual premium on the open market. So think about that. Think about the word affordability. So coverage, public-private. The extent to which, thirdly, a plan deals with cost and quality is going to be very important. The three legs of what is thought of in healthcare policy are coverage, cost, and quality. It is said facetiously that you can no way ever fix all three at the same time. Well, we're going to have to try to figure out how to do some of that. But the extent to which a program says we will address cost, we will address quality, is important. Think for a minute that the cost of healthcare in Florida in some procedures is up to 10 times what the cost for the same disease is in other parts of the country. Up to 10 times, somewhere between 2 and 10 times different in different parts of the country for different procedures with essentially the same results. That's bad quality. That's waste. So we've got to figure out, any presidential campaign, any presidential candidate has really got to address waste, has really got to address cost, has really got to address quality. But don't for a minute think that just because we can improve quality, that makes cost better. It does not in many situations. Sometimes it's actually more expensive to provide good quality. Now, one that does seem to do both, that makes quality better and cost better, is the electronic medical record. Now, I can't believe I'm saying that because I'm really not a geek, sort of. But electronic medical records for everybody are going to be very important. They're good for quality. They will presumably not permit somebody to have the same test three times in a row. They will have the results available. They will have practice guidelines embedded in them. And the administrative cost put out by an electronic medical record is a whole lot less than having a whole bunch of paper billing. So coverage, public-private, quality. Personal responsibility. Okay, any plan should address the notion that 40%, 40% of our life expectancy is due to lifestyle. Only 10% is due to medical care. So 40% of our life expectancy is due to smoking, is due to obesity, is due to murders, is due to terrorism. And so the things that are not specifically medical care, much of that has to do with how we conduct our lives. Now, at some point, we're going to have to get a little bit better about not being 350 pounds. And not necessarily doing things that harm ourselves. The extent to which any plan, in fact, stimulates people to do better and better about their lifestyles is something you'd like to have. And the last is how to pay for this. Right? With all the money in the world, we probably wouldn't be sitting here, or we'd be having a very, very different conversation. But as you look at plans, I would ask you to look very carefully, not just at what it says it will do, but how it will pay for it, and over what period of time. And you will be, I think, perhaps unhappy with the lack of specificity. It is very difficult, in fact, to say that we will cover 47 million, soon to be 50 million uninsured, and not say how we're going to pay for it. There are those that are out there, and I would ask you to look very carefully at some of the different plans that talk about, yes, we will have the money, getting it and actually saying what the signposts are over a 2, 5, 10-year period. I would think you might want to look a little bit more specifically at that. So having taken up exactly twice as much time as I'm supposed to have, brawn will turn over to brains. The real brains behind this. The good news about the 150 pages of notes is, unless you really want to read them, the book is actually the first 130 pages. So thank you all, and Professor Engelhardt.
Good morning. Thank you, Tim. Before I begin, I'd also like to say thank you to Peyton and Jan. Few people in this world have as special a place in my heart as Peyton Weary. He and I go way back. I'm always drawn to people who are just as crazy as I am about politics and healthcare and health policy, and Peyton was there before I was there, and he has been a mentor and a teacher to me, and I'm very appreciative. We also, along with Tim, sit on the board of the Free Clinic, and so we do lots of things together. Okay. So before I get into the different plans, and I don't want to get into them in a lot of specificity, we can do that during the Q&A if you'd like, I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the problems we have in our healthcare system, just very briefly. We can't talk about healthcare reform unless we talk about what it is we need to reform. And so, as by way of introduction, let me just say that we've got some real problems in our healthcare system. We're spending about 16% of our gross domestic product on healthcare. Its effectiveness is fairly questionable. The Commonwealth Fund just recently came out with a new report that looked at deaths that are amenable, preventable deaths that are amenable to health care. That means deaths that can be prevented because of health care. Very broad concept of health care, from prevention, primary care, all the way to specialty high-tech care. 5 years ago, of 19 industrialized countries, 5 years ago, we came in fourth from the last. This last year, we came in dead last in preventable deaths amenable to health care. Other countries had improved 19%. We had improved 4%. That says we've got some problems in our health care system. 160 million Americans receive health insurance where they work. It's a very inequitable system, because whether you work for a big company or a small company, or high wage or low wage, will make all the difference in the world whether you have comprehensive, coordinated health care or whether you have something much less. In addition, that tax preference for that employer-sponsored health care means that we have foregone taxes in the range of $200 billion a year. Many of us don't realize those sorts of things, and so that's something else that the plans are looking at, some of the plans are looking at as well. Health insurance premiums in this country have gone up 78% since 2001, 78%. Four times faster, higher, greater than wages or inflation. So what we're creating is a purchasing gap. Our dollars will not go as far, and health insurance is becoming unaffordable, both for employers who purchase it on behalf of their employees or together with their employees, as well as for individuals who purchase it in the individual market. 60% of employers offer health insurance. 5 years ago, it was 69%. So we're seeing an erosion of that as well, and that is a signal to us that our scaffold of providing health insurance in this country through our jobs is declining. Tim mentioned affordability and the 5% threshold. One out of five Americans under the age of 65, one out of five, spend more than 10% of after-tax income on health care. That means they can't save as much. That means they may not be able to pay their mortgages. They may not be able to pay their car payments. They may not be able to save. The number two reason for personal bankruptcy in this country is medical spending, medical bills. Okay. As you probably know, 47 million Americans do not have health insurance. That grows at about a rate of a million a year. The last time we were thinking about health care reform in the early 90s, when President Bill Clinton was elected the first time, There was about 37 million who didn't have health insurance, and now we're up to 47 million. And I'm here to tell you that the plans of our three candidates that are left standing today share many similarities. You may not think I was going to say that, but actually all three candidates, Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, Senator McCain, all have plans that propose improvements in preventive care, use of electronic medical records or health records. They support more information to patients and consumers. They support more transparency about quality and cost and price. They all promote better care, chronic care management. They all want to provide more options outside the workplace to purchase health insurance. They all use a combination of tax credits, tax deductions, or subsidies. And they all call for malpractice reform. So you might think, well, so what's the problem? Well, the problem is that philosophically, they're very different. Senator Clinton and Senator Obama's plans are very, very similar. The media has kind of gotten hold and run with this issue about the individual mandate for everyone versus insuring kids first. We can talk about that more during the Q&A if you want. Uwe Reinhardt had an editorial in the Philadelphia paper just last week who basically said, you know, let's move on. It's an important issue, but it's dividing the Democrats. Let's think about things that will bring them together and talk about other things, not the least of which that there's absolutely no guarantee that when whoever gets elected and takes office in January 2009 that we will have a Congress that will pass these things. So the Clinton and Obama plan are very, very, very similar. Hers costs out at $110 billion new dollars, his $50 to $60 billion new dollars, but they basically have the same strategy. She comes in with the whole package, which makes it very politically risky. We as Americans don't like to be told what to do. When I talk to people about this topic, what people say to me are, gee, is it really true Senator Clinton's going to garnish wages? We don't know. I don't think she knows. That's even assuming this would get passed. So anyway, they're very similar, as I mentioned. What I think we should talk about later today during the Q&A, what I think is really the crux of the issue, and I'm not going to talk very much longer, but things that we should look at are the philosophical differences. There are large philosophical differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. First one is universal coverage, which means everyone in the United States would have health insurance, is not a shared value. On the Republican side, it is more important to them, and I'm not saying this with any judgment, any value judgment, it is more important to them to get costs down, to look at making health insurance affordable, to keeping it less government regulated in order to attract and encourage private market participation. So universal coverage is not a given. That is not a shared value across the spectrum. Health system organization, Tim talked about public-private. That has some differences as well between the two parties. On the Democratic side, they believe very strongly that government's role is to either make markets work better or to fill in the gaps where markets don't work. They would do that by expanding government programs, specifically Medicaid and SCHIP, might allow for a buy-in to Medicare for 55-year-olds who have a hard time getting insurance when they take early retirement. And so there are fundamental differences in that area as well. Interestingly, Senator McCain's plan would actually transform the delivery system most radically. And that is because he proposes removing the tax preference from the employer-sponsored insurance program. and he, like President Bush, would recommend purchasing health insurance with after-tax income and paying for it with either a tax deduction or a tax credit. That would fundamentally change the way we receive health insurance in this country. Not very many people think about that, but that is a big difference. Democrats and Republicans also disagree about the basic purpose of health insurance. Democrats favor comprehensive insurance with front-end protection, which protects people from financial ruin, and that guarantees an entryway access and coverage to comprehensive health care. The Republicans, on the other hand, advocate a more consumer perspective, an individual perspective. Individual responsibility would be their mantra with regard to delivery system design. They recommend the use of catastrophic health plans and then some kind of health savings account or high deductibility so that people do not overuse or misuse. In the insurance industry, we call this moral hazard. The idea behind moral hazard is that if healthcare is subsidized, you don't really know how much it costs, you're going to use too much of it. The Republicans believe, all right, let's make people pay for it more out of their own pocket, and then they won't spend so much. They'll know how much it costs. It's a fundamental difference in the way you look at how health insurance is structured. And so I think I'm going to end with that. I'm sure you have lots of questions. If you want to know any of the specifics about the plans, I can tell you all three candidates support stem cell research. Other than that, there are lots of things they don't agree on. And we can get down to that level if you'd like, but at this point, I think someone told me once that you only have a 16-minute window and then people's minds start drifting. So I hope I still have you. And at this point, then, I'd like to open up for questions and discussion, and Tim and I'll be happy to answer. Thanks.
Let me invite those who have questions for Carolyn Engelhardt or Tim Garson to queue up in the back corner of the room. And we have about 30 minutes, so we should be able to take many questions. To sort of kick off the discussion, I'd like to ask Tim this. You draw a very important distinction in the book between medical care, which is the delivery by doctors or other healthcare professionals to the patient of care. You distinguish that from broad healthcare, which would concern changing things in the environment, worrying about school lunches, worrying about carcinogens that are spewed in the air by factories and so on. Whoever's elected president is not going to have unlimited means to attack both aspects of this, both health care and medical care. How would you, if you were advising the new president, recommend that the dollars be allocated between these two different needs?
That could be a terrific for the next debate, George. We have an expression in the Garson family, and that's whenever there's a dilemma, you do both. And so I think the answer in a big, broad way is you have to do both. Let me be not hide behind that and be a little bit more specific. There are, and if you go back to what George talks about the difference, healthcare, big stuff. The two big indices for healthcare, life expectancy, infant mortality. When people talk about healthcare, that's what they mean. Okay, we are 27th in the developed world for life expectancy, 34th for infant mortality. Our healthcare is terrible. Our healthcare is terrible. Okay, well, think about the statistic. The life expectancy in Harlem in New York City is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh. Fact. The infant mortality in Southeast Washington, D.C. is worse than the infant mortality in Nigeria. Fact. Now, is that medical care? No, that's not medical care. That's health care. So think of the things that go into that. And the idea that any president would ignore those public health issues, whether it is lifestyle, some of this is genetics, okay? The numbers in the book, Carolyn found this great article, which about the first six times I read it, I said it can't be, and about the seventh time I finally agreed. Okay, 40% lifestyle, of life expectancy, 40% lifestyle, 30% genetics, 20% public health, 10% medical care. So those things that we do, doctors, nurses, is a minority of what happens to people's lives. So you gotta do both, gotta do both. But the way to get, George, I think the answer is one of our chapters, the myth is that we waste half of our healthcare dollars. Well, we probably waste one third. And one third of $2 trillion is a lot of money. Okay, last time I looked, that's around $650 billion a year. The uninsured is $100 billion. So we waste a lot of money. The problem is capturing it. But that's excess medical care. That's doing too much. That's having too much administrative cost. So what I think any president would want to do is both, is figure out how to recapture, start to recapture some of the excess waste. That would be a tautology, excess waste, some of the waste, and be able, in addition, to begin attacking some of the public health issues in a public health sort of way with, as you've seen with some of the smoking things, anti-obesity campaigns. But remember, healthcare goes way broader than that. Healthcare is about murders. Healthcare is about drug abuse. Healthcare is about prison reform. Healthcare is about education. So it gets very broad, but I would think you'd have to do both.
The opening question today is from Dr. Weary.
First of all, I want to say how pleased I am that we have Tim and Carolyn here. Their book, I've read thoroughly. It's probably the most concise and wonderful summary of the complexity and the problems with healthcare that I know of. That's an observation. The question I have, and Tim, you alluded just briefly to it, is in regard to overhead costs. My understanding, and I may be wrong, but if you go to a single payer system such as Medicare, the overhead costs are somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3% overall. Whereas if you look at the private sector, private insurance managed care plans, the overhead costs are significantly higher, somewhere I've read as much as 10 to 15%. That, of course, would be one of the great savings if we were to go to a single-payer system. Am I correct in that? And if so, would you elaborate on that, perhaps?
With your permission, you directed the question to me. I'm about to turn to my left. Because the exact numbers Carolyn is going to do better at than I am. The concept is correct, Peyton. I'm not even sure, though, that you require a single payer to get to where you're talking about. What we need to do is wring a lot of that waste and the administrative waste out of the system. But the best numbers sit to my left.
Peyton, you're correct. Medicare is 3%. Medicaid is somewhere around 7% administrative cost, and private insurance billing 14%. We, of our healthcare dollar, they estimate somewhere between 25 and 30% is spent just sending paper through. One expert suggests that a hospital bill goes back and forth being resubmitted up to 10 times. So, yes, there's a huge amount of waste in that. We can get that down in other ways than a single payer. Americans, managed care taught us, if nothing else, Americans believe that quality is choice. Quality is a lot more than choice, but Americans really want choice. But we can squeeze out a lot of that inefficiency through better administrative systems, better information systems, standardization, those kinds of things.
Hi, my name is Dan Brody, and I have to be honest with you, I'm a vendor of EMRs and practice management systems, so from your lips to God's ears. But,
thank you.
Well, maybe not after I give you some statistics that I've seen. We have, George, you have to put it a little lower because I can't read my own writing. Approximately 370,000 of 650,000 physicians who actually are seeing patients practice in small private practices of four or less providers, and that's the group that we work with. Today, about 7 or 8% of that group have EMRs. Now, I think physicians are a pretty bright group of people. It's hard to get into med school. These are among our best and brightest, and why have only 7 or 8% of this group of people adopted EMRs? Well, I think they've done it because they have a sense that despite our hopes that these systems are not very productive for them and it's costing them money. The adoption rate, the failure rate, runs close to 50%, sometimes lower if they've done a good job of getting a physician advocate and making sure the physicians are behind the project. Often an administrator shoves this down their throat, and then they fight back because they don't like these physician order entry system in particular. The question is, how do we get the private sector to adopt when with the fee schedules that Medicare and Medicaid are paying them, physicians just can't, if they're going to bear this burden, how can they possibly afford it with shrinking incomes?
Can I start?
Sure.
Okay, I'll start, and then I'll turn it over to the physician who understands the way physicians think. the UK invests, I don't remember the exact figure, a tremendous amount per capita in information technology. Something like $10 per capita. They have a huge infrastructure of information. If I could show you a slide that I show my class, which I don't have handy, you would see that UK does the most, Germany does next, Canada does next, and then way at the bottom, the United States actually invests 43 cents per capita in information technology. Now, partially, that's because we don't have a national health system. We don't pay for health care through the government 100%. We do through Medicare and Medicaid, obviously. So some experts have suggested that in order to get electronic medical records up and going, the government will have to invest something like the Hill-Burton Act after the Second World War in building hospitals, that they'll have to then provide grants and loans to physician practices to incentivize them to put these systems in and then require them to be interoperable. It's one of those words in the industry, and to be standardized so that all payers can use that system. That's not the way we typically do things in the United States. We compete with each other. We have vendors that compete with each other's products, all of which don't communicate with each other. May I remind you about PCs and Macs? So some have suggested that it's going to have to be something like that. Now, Medicare already is requiring administrative billing. That will require certain systems to be in physicians' offices. So the easy answer is physicians don't do it because it costs a lot. They're afraid it's going to fail. The training, they lose productivity. It's a steep learning curve. And so one of the answers is maybe we need a little more public investment in it.
We did Y2K fairly well. It happened. I would think that before too long, we're going to have to figure out that this has got to happen. Now, this strikes me as the difference between the racehorse and the automobile. And at some point, we've all got to wake up and decide there's an automobile. Now, it's going to happen. It has to get a little better, but the Model T was not the Corvette. And I just personally believe we're going to have to put a sword in the sand, incentivize doctors, get the systems as well as they can be, as quickly as they can be, and then if the carrots don't work, some sticks may be required.
My name is Jim Hill, and contrary to Dr. Garrison's opinion, there are a few of us white hairs around. All of our medical care is received from UVA, and we are also members of Part B, Plan B, or D, I'm sorry. The question is, I peruse the billings quite seriously when we get the billings back. UVA will bill Medicare $3,000, $2,000, whatever that number is. Medicare will pay $387.46. The same thing is true with prescriptions. Our prescriptions all come from the same dealer. A prescription for Plavix is $502.47, I believe.
A day.
Humana allows $334 or something like that. And the question is twofold. I guess, first of all, this is not truth in medicines, really, when you get one bill and they pay something else. And secondly, if you didn't have, fortunately, we're on Medicare. If we were not on Medicare or did not have Plan D, we would be stuck with the large number instead of the smaller number, and I don't think that's really fair.
Let me go. Welcome to the U.S. healthcare system. This is our version of universal coverage. We charge people different rates for the same thing in order to cover gaps and holes and provide a profit. It is very inefficient. It's unfair. There was the same lawyer who represented the attorneys general in the tobacco settlement tried to put together a class action lawsuit for the uninsured who were being charged retail prices for hospital services. It didn't find its way in court, and many hospitals, because it did shine a light on that practice, now index the cost to the uninsured to Medicare fee schedule. Some do, some don't. But the name of the game in the U.S. healthcare system is cost shifting. We charge some more to cover. Medicare pays 94 cents on the cost dollar. Medicaid pays much worse and is determined by each state. So each state determines what they will pay their providers under Medicaid. Hospitals cannot exist if they do not make their cost. So they have charges, and those charges are differential depending on who the payer is. They charge private pay more to make up for the public payers that pay less. Your plan has negotiated a rate, a formulary, other kinds of things that you then will pay. And you're exactly right. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense, except from a hospital standpoint that cannot go bankrupt, and they have to find ways of charging, and that's what we do. And if you ask the private payers, you ask Humana, why do they do this? They'll say, number one, I'm a business, I'm not a charity. And number two, look at the millions and millions and millions of dollars we give to communities in pro bono care, as the pharmaceutical industry, free medicines. This is how we do it. We take from one, we give with the other, we have differential rates, and at the end of the day, all the stakeholders try to keep their head above water.
A question was handed to me from someone in one of the overflow rooms. How much does the threat of a lawsuit affect the cost of health care? In other words, what are the costs of our malpractice compensation system?
That is a bear to get at. And I can give you the the reasoning behind why it's a very, very difficult question to answer. Okay, the number that's used, so answer the question, Tim, 3%. That's the number that's used of what the cost, not of defensive medicine, but the actual direct cost of lawsuits in the United States is around 3% of healthcare. Now, having said that, imagine the only way, and I took part 15 years ago in a panel that tried to see, could you look at a chart, could you look at any medical record and determine whether that doctor ordered that test because they were afraid of being sued or did that operation? It is an impossible, you cannot. We spent 3 days going through a bunch of different things and decided it is not possible to do that. There is not an automatic that says, okay, if I am in this situation, I only get this test because I'm frightened. So you can't do that. So how do you do it? You have to ask people. So you have to say, okay, doctor, why did you do that test? Now, the problem with that is there's a, and in the book, we found that the pair of articles that was in the OBGYN literature, that in fact, when they asked the doctors the first time, they said they were worried about getting sued. And when they went back the second time and said, are you sure? They said, well, maybe we were sort of uncertain. Well, maybe we wanted to make a little money. Well, maybe we wanted to do the right thing. So the easiest thing, when you're asked a question, certainly in public, to come out with is, I'm worried about getting sued. That's not always the underlying answer. So it is very difficult. There are numbers all the way up to 16%. There are numbers that are really high. But the fact of the matter is it's very difficult to tell.
My name is Ted Parlett. I'm a retired professor from the Virginia Medical Center and volunteer at the Free Clinic. And I have a question regarding coverage for some of the folks that come to the Free Clinic. I think that accessibility and coverage are intimately related. Some of the folks at the Free Clinic need services that we cannot provide. We refer them to UVA, where I practiced for a number of years. Physicians can waive their fee, but the university is either unwilling or unable to waive the facilities fee, which makes it impossible for them to get care. And I wondered what your take on that was.
The number, and I think I'm right, is actually the same for both physicians and the hospital, which is that under 100% of poverty, under 100% of the federal poverty level, which for an individual is $10,000 a year and for a family of four is $20,600 a year. For someone under 100% of poverty, it's free. For someone over 200% of poverty, it is full ride. And between 100% and 200% of poverty, it's a sliding scale. Now, again, if you get back to what we were talking about of what insurance costs, you don't get to 5% of income until you're at 600% of poverty. So in an ideal world, in fact, healthcare, medical care, should be subsidized in an ideal world up to 600% of poverty. It's just nobody's there yet. So unfortunately, again, to quote Engelhard to you, welcome to the American healthcare system. It is not ideal. What you would, in an ideal way, is subsidize people up to 600% of poverty, but nobody's that money just isn't there.
Also, I would just add that Erica Vixilio, our executive director of the Free Clinic, is somewhere out there, and she does a masterful job making relationships with specialty physicians and others in the community to provide referral services. In fairness to UVA, and it's not just because I work there, UVA has a tremendous uncompensated care load every year that they then don't get reimbursed for, millions and millions of dollars every year that they provide care they never get any payment for. So there's the local level of uninsured and what we need. there's sort of the Central Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina people who come to UVA who can't pay, don't pay, that we end up writing off. And then there's the macro nationwide problem.
As you've pointed out, those people who oppose free or socialized medicine suggest that the cost would go up because people would overuse the systems. But in my understanding, in countries that have free or socialized medicine, costs are actually less because people tend to go earlier or have better preventive care. Are there studies to either point?
This is chapter 6 in our book.
And the data got a whole lot better 3 weeks ago.
And this is probably the number one, you know, they say that healthcare reform is the third rail of American politics. I'd like to say chapter 6 is the third rail of our book, because that says preventive care saves money. And I will let Dr. Garson talk to you about that.
Third rail. Remember, all the book is myths. So preventive care does not save money. All right, now, before you all faint and start charging the stage in the next 4 minutes. Let me give you some data in a minute, but say that preventive care is the right thing to do. All right, this is not about, is preventive care the right thing? Of course preventive care is the right thing. And of course, we gotta do it. And of course, it works in children, it works in the middle-aged, it works in the elderly. Works means keeps you alive, happier, and healthier. Works does not mean saves enough money for a healthcare reform candidate to take that money and pay for the uninsured. Okay? And you're all, okay, you get it. So let me give you some data. Data came out 3.5 weeks ago, actually 4 weeks ago, the week of February 7th, from a study in Holland. And the study showed that smokers in Holland die at the age of 77 and save $100,000 compared to thin people who don't smoke who die at 84. Obese people, largely who die of heart disease and diabetes, die at 80 and save $50,000 in medical care costs throughout their life. Not between 80 and 84, but overall medical care costs, $50,000 less for those that die at 80 compared to those that die at 84. Now, that is stark, startling, anger-provoking, et cetera, but true data. The next day comes out an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, February 14th, Happy Valentine's Day. So if any of you want to go to the web and look it up, there is a very well-done article, of all things, the senior author, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, that demonstrated that of all preventive care, 19% saves money. Okay, 81% costs money. Now again, it's not that it's the wrong thing to do, please, over and over again. But if, and go look at the healthcare proposals out on the web, if those people say, we will take money from preventive care and pay for the uninsured, the money is not there. Not that it's the wrong thing to do, it's just the money is not there.
And with regard to other countries, they have other. Most countries have an explicit rationing system. Now, I know that's the R word that nobody likes to hear. We ration in this country as well every single day based on ability to pay and whether you have health insurance. That's called implicit rationing. Other countries do it explicitly. They slow down the new technologies that come out. They don't give everybody an MRI when they walk into the emergency department. They don't have 12 different statins on their formularies. And they do it in different ways. But it's a decision each country makes for themselves. But certainly through explicit rationing, you can control costs better.
My question actually was the one that you just answered in a way, but I wanted to continue on it because my question was about the study that came out of the Netherlands and how if you are trying to eat right, exercise, not smoke, and do all the good things, that you think you're doing something good for the health system, and now I find out I'm not, so I think I'm getting depressed. Would you?
And that's equally expensive paying for it. You're not, this isn't about you doing something for the health system. This is about you doing something for you. And, you know, this is about you. And in fact, you are doing something for the health system because what we're about is health, right? What we're about is health. We waste so much money that the idea of saying that we should, you know, that, gee, we're expensive the longer we live. No, the thing that I wrote the next day in that op-ed was quoting my father for real, that, and he was sort of an aging expert, and said that the whole purpose of aging was to make early old age last as long as possible and late old age last 15 minutes. And if you can pull that off, preventive care will then save money. The issue is that unfortunately late old age is expensive.
First of all, let me thank you for a wonderful educational presentation. Very, very helpful, and I appreciate your being here very much. My name is Al Strickler. I do have some affiliation with the health system at UVA by virtue of being a volunteer in the emergency medicine department. I have a question because I lived in Canada in the 1970s when he instituted medical care for everyone, and we all got a plastic card, and we swiped it like a Visa card when we went to the doctor. And two things happened, and I wonder what your answers are for these things. First of all, my doctor said to me while I was sitting there talking to him several months before the system went in, he said, based on what I'm going to get paid, your visit will now last 6.3 minutes from now on, and we're not going to sit here and talk about your backhand or your forehand. The second thing that happened was, it's a provincial program, as you know. The province of Quebec estimated the cost and underestimated by over 100%, because under the old system, when you paid, if you sniffled or had a headache, you didn't go to the doctor. When you had a swipe card and you sniffled and got a headache, you went to the doctor. And so costs got out of control and you had much less time with the doctor. Are there answers for these two situations?
Most of the surveys I read, and I've not been to Canada, but it is interesting to me, the Canadian Medical Association has fought, given up. They do not want privatization in Canada for the most part. They like their system, or at least they don't. Tim and I talk about this in the book. The Canadian motto is peace, order, and good government. Peace, order, and good government. That reflects who they are. Our analog is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Very different values when you think about it. There was that lawsuit in Canada by the gentleman who had to wait a year to get his hip replaced. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you know, yeah, you're right. You are not, and you do not have access because you've been waiting for a year for your hip. So there are problems. This goes back to the explicit rationing. I think most people believe that Canadian system was underinvested in for several decades. I think it's changing a little bit now. Most of the, anecdotally, I haven't lived there. Most of the things I read is that, generally speaking, Canadians are very happy with their healthcare system. They don't worry about who's going to pay. They don't worry if they can pay. They don't worry about going bankrupt. Yes, sometimes they have to wait a little bit longer for certain things, and they don't like that, and it's a trade-off.
Full details about the broadcast, both on the website and on PBS, will be available on the Miller Center website, millercenter.org. I think this discussion today has certainly shown the contours, the outlines of what the debate on April 9th will be. And we're very grateful to Carolyn Engelhard and Tim Garson for opening the discussion. Thank you both.
Thank you.